you. So Carolina is going to make some comments before we open it up for discussion.
Okay, so can everybody hear me? Should I be using the mic? Thank you for your talk. And I know that everyone is dying to for the discussion to start, so I will really be very, very brief here. But I have many, many questions, and since I do have the privilege to start this off, what I want to do is pull out three themes that were running through your talk and that run through your book, and that's, to me at least, are vital to any discussion of automated weapons and the future of warfare. And so I identify those three themes as, firstly, robotic technology, secondly, the tension between impunity and what you refer to in the book following Walter is this notion of radical responsibility. And the third theme is one of which I think as an Arendtian theme of thinking, right, as something that is a necessary human activity and must necessarily, well, certainly accompany warfare, but everything that happens before people resort to warfare. So I'm going to say something about each of those three themes and raise some questions. So the first issue is technology, and here I'm going to be quoting from your book. So as you say, and I quote, we walk in the time of robots. Artificial intelligence resides in our weapon systems, and it flies, drives, and sails with us regularly. If it is possible that we have allowed ourselves into the place we are today without much debate and introspection, is it possible we are capable of doing the same as our technological capabilities increase? So you say that the answer to this question is a resounding yes, and you then offer this striking quote, which in my copy I marked with three exclamation points, which is a quote from the Department of Defense Unmanned Systems Roadmap. And I'm going to read it. So quote, when the procurement, so that's from the Unmanned Systems Roadmap. When the procurement of unmanned systems threaten manned systems budgets or career paths of manned systems operators, the manned systems invariably win out due to vocal and forceful remonstrations by the threatened communities. Unmanned systems offer as yet largely unseen operational capability, and these pockets of resistance need to be addressed and eliminated for the overall good of the joint force. I'll just let that sink in. Okay, so what we have here is this runaway process of technological development where new systems are being designed with the view towards ever more efficient warfare. And our thinking is lagging. And the laws of war and the policies that drive current war making seem to be stuck in a different era. What we have, and actually, it really, your talk made me realize the extent to which this is the case, what we have, the only thing that we have as guidance, right, are the laws of war, which put forth these doctrines that are based on this notion of intent, right, of meaningful human intent, where we can decide what this person was trying to accomplish when deciding to pursue a given course of action, which seems almost quaint in the context of, you know, what you had talked about. So in other words, with this extraordinary increase in technological capability, we are missing the normative framework. It has not caught up. And, of course, many of us who study security technologies worry about this and have thought about this, but this is a really striking example. So my question here is, can we perhaps think a little bit about Exactly, specifically, what are the factors that are inhibiting our thinking, that are inhibiting this capacity that we have to reflect? And I'm here, I'm mindful, I'm using the word we, but I realize that there are different communities doing the reflecting, and that reflecting might be going in very different directions. So I'm qualifying the we. But, and then there's those who don't at all, but anyway. So is it possible that there are powerful agents who have a very strong interest in the Department of Defense not questioning unmanned systems and issuing statements like the one I just read, right? And you do allude to it at a certain point in your book, right? It's not, war is not just politics by other means, but it's also business. And so is it possible that there are specific forces, market forces are the ones I'm particularly interested in, that promote the embrace of the high-tech military by politicians, and that distort how the public sees it? So that's one question. And so now moving on to the second issue, that is the issue of the tension between impunity and responsibility. So responsibility is a concept that I've been particularly interested in my own work. I'm not going to talk about that much, but all I want to say is that it seems that we live in a time when responsibility is constantly invoked, and yet in pretty contradictory ways. It can have different meanings. We can be responsible in the sense that we shoulder the blame for something that we did wrong, or we can be responsible in the sense that we have a duty to act in a certain way or refrain from doing certain things. And in the civilian world, it is a contested concept. But I always imagine that in the military, with its strict hierarchy, with its strict chain of command, this idea of responsibility would be much less ambiguous. But your discussion of impunity sheds a whole new light on this. And so the question I have here is about that. Who ought to be considered responsible in the moral, and perhaps then in the legal sense as well, in those cases where you cited the numbers of which you were pointing out were not necessarily certain, but nonetheless, numbers greater than zero of civilians who have been killed by drone strikes. So who is responsible in those cases, in the cases when the wrong targets are struck, etc., right? What is the role of commanders? What is the role of the system designers? Connecting this to the discussion with which Lucy opened about what constitutes meaningful human control, who is responsible and who can be held accountable in what ways? And so this is something, and as you brought in the attack of the Navy SEALs on Osama bin Laden's compound, and so that makes me wonder, are you saying that really indeed that is that actually sending perhaps special forces is what should replace any attempts to expand the use of automated weapons? So that would be the kind of second area. And my final point is on the necessity of proper thought. And I don't want to talk much about that, but I was struck by the point in your book where you were told by a senior Department of Defense official that, and again I quote, "We don't ask our privates to read Kant and to ruminate on the ethics of waging war." And that's fair enough, I suppose. Then you say also that you are pretty pessimistic about the possibility that your argument could influence policymaking. But I still wonder, and I want to hear from you as from someone who does read Kant and who cares deeply about preserving what is human in war, if you can think of any strategy of challenging the kinds of policy decisions that appear to have already been made. Thank you.
people have questions, but I think we should give you, Shane, a minute to respond.
Respond to that? Okay, so first one, the barriers to thinking, is that the first one? And then the second one is the, what was the second one again? Yes, I love that one. And then this last one, the strategies for trying to get people to think about it. I'd like to talk about the responsibility piece for just a second. To me, this is one of the most important aspects of this. And along with this Italian brigadier general who states that, you know, he would never send a weapon that he doesn't know exactly what it's going to do, you know, even when it's operating within its normal parameters, I think that's an interesting concept. And I would state that we've already done that. It's already happening. I'll tell you a real quick war story. So I was in Utah with my squadron, and we had gone to do what we call weapon systems evaluation program. So we show up, we put a missile, a bomb, whatever, on the airplane, right from the field, except that they take the warhead off and they put a telemetry pack on it. And then they test our, you know, maintainer's capability and our weapons loader's capability to load it up, and they test our ability of the aircraft's ability to communicate with it, and it's a you know, full test of the entire chain. And one of my friends was shooting a particular kind of missile, and I was sitting in the telemetry shop watching the whole thing go down, and then we would debrief it afterwards, where the engineers would pull all the data and, you know, show it to us on what it actually did at various times. And so he took the shot, and we're sitting there in the debrief, and I hear one of these engineers, a guy who's responsible for writing the code for this particular weapon system, he says, "Whoa, we didn't know it was going to do that." And I was like, "Whoa, hang on a second there, Johnny. What do you mean? You know, I thought you guys were the ones who wrote the code." I mean, science and engineering is all about making events happen over and over in the same manner, right? That's why we do engineering. And so I was a little bit taken aback by that. And he said, "Yeah, this weapon system has a capability to seek out other targets. So it can be programmed that if the one target that we send it after doesn't happen to be there or be doing what we think it's supposed to be doing, we can program it with other systems that may be around there, and it actually can seek them out on its own. It's an autonomous weapon. It makes the decision after it leaves my airplane on what it's going to attack." That's why I say we are walking in the time of robots. This is happening. The responsibility piece for that is really interesting, and I wrote an article about it, unpublished article about this, about what's the responsibility of the military commander in the case of, you know, fielding and using these autonomous weapons. I know this AI part that I talked about that, you know, surrounds me in a fire cockpit, I understand the engineering that goes into it, and I know in some sense some of what it's doing. So, you know, there are some IV kind of things that go on, certain kind of engineering things that you can make radars do to kind of tell you who it thinks that is. You know, and I understand the limitations of it, and I understand and have memorized the table of ambiguities so that I know when I see certain reading, it could be this and it could be that, and there's a certain probability that it's, you know, this or that. And I can train to that. And as a fighter squadron commander, I can train my fighter pilots to that. And I'm responsible for their training as a commander. So if one of my guys goes out and does the wrong thing on something that he should have known, on knowledge that he had access to and did not use correctly, he's responsible and I'm responsible because I didn't clearly train him for what he was supposed to do. But when we get to autonomous weapons that make their own decisions, particularly after they leave the rail, where does that responsibility lie? So in the case of this weapon system that I'm talking about, similar to the other example, I know all the ambiguities. I understood all of the likely events there. But there could be a time when we build a robot that makes decisions on lethality after it has left the control or the knowledge base of the military member who is supposed to be firing it. Now who's responsible? Is it the programmer? Is it the company? And this goes to law, really, and it's about liability law. We're going to find very few defense contractors who are going to want to sell us weapons if we tell them, oh, by the way, if it does something bad, we're going to come after you and throw you in the hay. They're not going to sell us anything. All right? And so there's some constraints in civil law that we have to consider. That's my fear. As a military commander, I want to test those that I'm responsible for. And some people talked about this, you know, war in a can. This would be great. We'll have all these robots, we'll put them in this can, we'll sit them over here, and then when we need them, we'll just break them out. And we'll send them in. Well, who's going to test them? Who's going to train with them? What commander's going to walk in there? This is what this Italian general is talking about. And go, send in the droids. Oh, by the way, I have no idea what it is they're going to do. But I know that I'm responsible and you can string me up if something bad goes wrong. You're going to find a lot of people not willing to do that either. And that's going to affect the all-volunteer force that we currently have. And it's going to affect military professionalism. So I think that's an excellent, I don't have an answer, as you can clearly tell, but it's a great point to discuss and to think about and to write about. What are the barriers? You know, there's a lot of barriers to what we do. You know, I mean, Eisenhower warned us about it ages ago, industrial military complex. There's a great graphic. If you go to Lockheed Martin, which is in Fort Worth, Texas, a great town, Cowtown, USA, they call it, at Lockheed Martin's headquarters down there where they built the F-16 and they're building the F-35, there's a graphic of all the defense contractors that we used to have, like 1930s-ish, and it's just a line chart. And so it's all these, bought. Everybody heard of Bach Aircraft Company, Those kinds of companies, Bell, those kinds of things, they do this as mergers happen, as time goes down, and we're down to five. There were 50, 60 defense contractors before. We now have five big ones, two of which were mentioned earlier. You know, there's a giant lobbying force right there in five major international corporations employing lots of people with a huge war chest. And of course there are issues with that. There are issues with not just that, and all can we cast it the other way. You guys are researchers, you have to get grants to do certain research. Institutions that go to the Department of Defense or the Ministry of Defense to get some kind of research funding, there's similar conflicts of interest there. There's issues with what it is you're actually trying to find out and what you will end up writing about and speaking in the report. So yeah, I think there's some major barriers to communicating this and some drive certainly to increase the technological capability of our militaries. I don't think it's as sinister as a lot of people make it out to be. It's business. And that's that's the world we live in. I don't think there's anybody out there going, man, we need to, you know, get this and do that so that we can, you know, create this master race of robots. It isn't that kind of thing. And I don't think it's necessarily sinister that places like DARPA and other research organizations try to do, you know, engineering and science for engineering and science sake. Right? The problem is when engineering and science for engineering and science sake becomes a cool toy on a shelf. I already talked about we're a technological society, you know, love my iPad, love my computer, love my iPhone. I didn't have any of that stuff about 5 years ago. Love it. Right? I see some shiny objects, right, and I want it. And that is part of the problem. So the Predator drone was a advanced technology demonstrator at DARPA before it was a major project for the Air Force. The PacBot was another one mentioned earlier. You know, they were trying to do cool science. There's cool stuff going on at DARPA right now, you know, actual transforming robots. I've seen them. They're not like the actual big transformers. They're more like, you know, tubes of goo right now, but they roll around and can get smaller and go through tiny holes and then expand later, and they self, you know, they move themselves, and there's all that kind of stuff. Cool stuff going on at DARPA. You know, so it's when it becomes cool enough that somebody goes, man, I need that, and put it in the military and take it right off the shelf as an advanced technology demonstrator and try to make it a full-blown system. So I think that's, those are some of those issues. And then what was the third one again? Yeah, the strategy. Yeah, I don't know. And I'm probably not the guy to comment on that, frankly. And you know, because there's a disclaimer on my first slide there, I'm still an Air Force officer, and I don't comment on policy generally. I'm making comments on morality and the philosophy and those kinds of things, but you know, I that's why I have not answered emails from the organization to what's it called?
International, yeah. Committee for Robots.
Yeah, I haven't answered their emails asking me to join because I can't do that, and I think that it's not necessarily my place to make those kinds of policy comments. So I'll leave it at that with a giant dodge, and you can find me later and persecute me for it if you so desire.
Okay, so I mean, I would just say that I think your book is a contribution to those campaigns in ways that don't require you to sign up for them. But we have to have now a little less than a half an hour before we go out and eat and drink. So, and I'm going to just pass the microphone around.
Thank you very much. I'm Maureen McNeil from the Center for Science Studies and the Department of Sociology here. And your talk for me is quite a challenge because I'm not used to thinking about these issues from the critical perspectives of someone who describes themselves as the military commander. And in attempting to think about that, there were two areas that I was really curious about. One was, where does this great push and desire for impunity come from? And I'm curious about that because the history of warfare, as I understand it in the Western world, has always revolved around a population that in some way was disposable. And it's always been the weak, it's always been the poor, it's always been those who don't have alternatives, who are the prime part of that fighting force. And I'm just curious about, for that reason, why this sudden concern and desire to minimize impunity. And related to that, I'm also curious, and your talk made me think more about the increasing spectacles and investment in certain kinds of memorials when there are military victims. Certainly that's been much more, the rituals have increased demonstrably in the UK, and I think we've seen more of that, and I wonder how that relates to it. So that's one cluster. And the second one is really about...
Why don't you take that one and then...
Okay. So, what's driving it? Well, there's a supposed risk aversion going on in primarily Western militaries that I think it comes about from I think a recognition perhaps of what actually happens in the depths of war that no one really understood necessarily before probably around the Vietnam era, where newsmen were on the battlefield and almost instantaneously for the late 60s and 70s, that's being shown on the news. The warrior has always understood what happens in the depth of war. But the reason that we have warriors and that we have combatants, and they're not the same thing, in my opinion, is so that other parts of society don't need to do that. What's the purpose of having an army? You don't have to have the entire population pick up and bear arms. That's why you have a standing army, right? So I think there's some recognition that happens because of the actually seeing some of it. And I think that has increased as technology has improved. You can see video on YouTube from actual weapon seekers as they go in and take out SAM sites and those kinds of things in Iraq. One of the tasks I was actually on. You know, and you see this bomb, you don't see the bomb, you see the video from this bomb as this SAM system gets bigger and bigger in its field of view, and you see the door fly open. And you see this young Iraqi conscript who heard this weapon. They make an enormous amount of noise. It's just gliding. But the air that it's pushing makes an enormous amount of noise. And he hears it. The door flies open and he attempts to run away, and then it goes, you know, snow screen. So you actually witness, you know, that. Exactly the way that the guy in the fighter cockpit saw. I think part of that is maybe a rationale for this. The other is that, you know, I'm not sure that I would agree with the supposition that certainly in modern times that it's the poor of the weak, you know, and the endangered that bear the bonds. Perhaps in old times, maybe, but there were plenty of people who did it for profit, even back then. The draft and conscripting folks is maybe part of that. And I know there's some reaction to the draft, particularly during the Vietnam time frame, that seemed like it was not equitable among socioeconomic populations. But given that, you know, slight disagreement, we're not a draft force anymore. We're an all-volunteer force. So
I can't resist briefly jumping in, because there are people who characterize the current U.S. force as, or a recruitment process as a poverty draft, basically, that it takes advantage of the numbers of people who are without any other options.
Yeah, I think that. Certainly welcome to that opinion. I find that disconcerting, frankly, as a senior military member. it's not like we're scraping the bottom of the barrel. Our force right now is better educated than it's ever been in the history of military. Certainly, maybe people are volunteering to get education and to get, you know, health benefits and all of those kinds of things. Guess what? That's happened for ages and ages. So maybe I personally don't buy into it. Not the airmen and soldiers that I've worked with. I just frankly don't find that to be accurate.
Okay. I have one here and one here.
Thank you very much. I'd like to, I have two questions to connect about. One is just definition and some clarity. That's about the term impunity, and then related to that question of responsibility. Now, in other contexts, impunity is pretty much defined as not being subject to criminal prosecution and punishment, evading punishment. That's what's often meant. And I realize that you don't use it in this way, and you have more code from the Knesset that also seems to be kind of playing loose with the term. But if you could clarify what you mean by impunity, what you don't mean, that would be useful. Connected to that, the talk about responsibility, as Kelly mentioned, there are different ways in which responsibility is accepted, ascribed, and performed. And one important distinction is responsibility as an ethos, because to be a person is to be responsible, to be capable of responsibility for your actions, possibly of the actions of others, including your children. And in military organizations, often the persons you're commanding.
Right.
So that's an ethos question. It's very different from the question of, again, legal responsibility. And on that front, really bluntly to say, no responsibility ever happens for things that are done without automated weapons. Like, if we look at the record of what major Western powers and legal responsibility for violence that has acknowledged to have been wrong, has been violating all kinds of standards that have been agreed to by everybody in question, legal responsibility has never been happened. The ethos of responsibility is super important because that really drives the meaningfulness of the war. However, that's an ethos that's very different from a rogue migrant, from the underlying realities that for soldiers, there is pretty much a built-in impunity of this other kind for the convicting agent, although the laws would say otherwise, and that's exactly the nice crunchy.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. What I mean by impunity is probably immunity from attack. So I can prosecute an attack and no one can prosecute one against me. That's how I use that term. I guess to the second part, you know, first you have to agree that there is legally sufficient data and information to proceed down the path of some kind of prosecution. That's an assumption that you're making that I'm not sure that we're to the point yet. Now, certainly, people have gone free for committing crimes because there is not enough legally sufficient information to back up a prosecution. That's not new to the warfare. It happens all the time. I don't, maybe if you're limiting it solely to legal impunity from prosecution of over what you believe to be crimes against humanity or war crimes, probably nobody has come under the gun for that in this situation. And I think it's what Philip Alston was talking about, is that no one's giving out that information. I don't know who's actually doing all of that. And nobody in here actually does, because we're not talking about who actually is pulling the trigger, who actually is making the decision. Nobody understands that. Nobody really knows that, because governments are holding that information from individuals who may want to pursue it. So the other piece of that is that the question back is, you know, is it the which part of it are we reacting to when we talk about no one's ever held responsible? Are we reacting to the actual targeting of individuals that people say are illegal combatants or combatants or terrorists or however you want to label them? Or are we reacting to the non-combatant deaths that seem to accompany those? Because to me, those are two completely different questions. So the question that is simply about the non-combatants deaths, the questions go back to this doctrine of double effect, and we have to understand intent, and we have to figure out proportionality, and we have to make all of those kinds of decisions. If we're talking about, hey, we just don't like the fact that we're actually wailing on people that we think are bad people, you know, that's a different question, and it's a valid question, but with the decision process is different, and the who gets held responsible is different. Very important in just war ethic that jus ad bellum and jus in bello were different constructs, separate. And the responsibilities for those decisions that get made in jus ad bellum, the should questions, those reside on the legitimate authority. Those reside on the people who send the military in to do things. That's who has to answer for those things. The jus in bello criteria, the proportional use of force, the distinction between combatants and non-combatants, and the assessment of the collateral damage when told to execute against a certain target, though that responsibility resides among the combatants who are doing the act. That's why you can fight a bad war well. That's why Rommel was never put on trial, other than the fact that he killed himself, but would not have been put on trial at Nuremberg. He fought a bad war well. World War II, when you break it down, was fought against the Nazi crime of aggression. Rommel refused orders to summarily execute prisoners, actually returned some prisoners across lines to British and to U.S. tank units. He was very well respected by those he opposed for his actions in war. You know, Patton, famously, highly respected Rommel, said, "I read your book. You can fight a bad war well." Right? And the responsibility there for all of the destruction, not on Rommel's shoulders, but should have been on the Third Reich's shoulders. So those are, I think, interesting. I need a little more, you know, information and data to kind of figure out where it is that you're really coming from on it, but that's kind of one perspective from the just war ethic.
Thank you for coming. It will be easier to talk to a military audience. I appreciate you coming. What I was curious about was you said you would like to test those you are responsible for. And you said that I've told this interesting story about the weapon with the AI that did something it shouldn't. I was just curious, what happens in your position if you refuse to be responsible for that? I mean, can you say, what's your position in all this? Can you say, I'm not being involved in that particular weapon because it does this? And what would happen within your chain of command or within your position?
Great question. So I am, again, it's an all-volunteer force. Nobody's making me do what I do. I do it completely by choice. And therefore, when there are, you know, if, it hasn't happened yet, if there were things that, you know, were things that I could not stomach, you know, what we do is we resign. You don't, this is an interesting thing about
it. So it's difficult to contend.
Yes, because here's the problem. because of the way the U.S. Constitution, it's not a problem. It's actually the way it is, and probably for the better. Civilian control over the military and the civil-military relationship, very, very important, constitutionally important in the United States military. The reason why we've had chiefs of staff that resigned, chief of staff of the Air Force, our top general, who would resign, and his commentary was that this happened over, you know, you guys remember the bombing in Copart Towers. So we have a bunch of fire units, heavy units, tankers, and sitting in Saudi Arabia. We're doing Operation Southern Watch, enforcing UN the marshes that put in place to protect the Shia in the south from Saddam after Desert Storm. And a suicide bomber drove the truck up to the fence and set off this huge truck that blew up part of the dormitory and lost about 27 or so military members in this terrorist attack. The general who was in charge of the base, Brigadier General Schwaler, was redlined for promotion to a second star and was investigated, not prosecuted in terms of what, you know, lawyers would maybe like, but in terms of what, you know, the military considers to be a prosecution at times, which is, you know, it ended his career. He had to retire as a Brigadier General. That's one of the common themes that you sometimes hear. When we do find wrongdoing and then we, you know, end up picking somebody up. Yes, he retired as a Brigadier General. He was going other places. And wasn't really his fault, you know. He was a scapegoat, essentially. That was the opinion of my chief of staff at the time. His name was Ron Fulton. And he resigned. In his statement, he didn't say that he was against the decision of the Department of Defense to prosecute this individual who he didn't think had done anything wrong. He said, I'm out of step with the civilian leadership, and I cannot be effective as a representative of all the airmen in the United States Air Force. So that's what we have to do.
Okay.
Because you do not want a general officer stepping in and trying to usurp civilian control of the military. It's for the society to deal with. It's not for me to deal with. It's not for me to make the case and to, by resigning gloriously and being on the front page of the Washington Post. It's the responsibility of the citizens of the United States to understand what their military is being asked to do and to take it into the voting booth and to take it into the thought process of how we decide to elect a president, how we decide to interact with that individual. It has to be that way.
Thank you. I want to thank you for your comments, Colonel Boyd. I'm a big fan of his.
Right.
I was thinking about your example of the Bin Laden raid. And you mentioned that you were going to possibly come back and address the issues later. I was wondering if, you know, your claim for the superiority of the decision-making of that SEAL, that situation, over a remote command situation, is that a factor in a particular technological moment? Is that a factor of the greater amount of data available to an operator through all the senses as opposed to just the camera? Or is it a moral moment as well? And how do those factors break out for you?
Yes. I think it's all of those, and so specifically that example is, the question is, you know, send in the SEALs or some well-trained Marine with a rifle or whatever, or, you know, drop a 2,000-pound bomb or, you know, shoot a hellfire. Those are the two kind of questions. The question is not necessarily, you know, what if I take that hackbot with face recognition software and drive that thing into the door. That's not the question that I'm talking about necessarily. I think that there are a lot of issues with that, and I think the technology, the press of the technology is way out in front of the actual capability. I reference in the book an experiment done by the Office of Naval Research where they had some UAVs, I think four of them, flying around, collaborating with each other, building search patterns, trying to track this one individual. And this one individual, they had face recognition software, but they also had him wearing like an orange vest, you know. So it's relatively rudimentary. He's the only one walking on the street that they built, you know. It's not like New York City, you know, subway or anything like that. And it's just kind of to test the collaboration capability of air and ground robots. And then they have these ground robots, their little tricycle, you know, gear kind of robots. I can't remember the company who makes them, but they're, you know, they're driving around like little segways, basically, you know, tracking this guy. And then we get to the boundary of its, you know, its zone, and it would, you know, hand off this information to this other one, and it would start tracking. It's a really cool kind of experiment, you know. But one of these bigger robots, there are several different size robots, one of the Segway-sized robots, at one point, did not recognize one of the smaller robots as a robot, and recognized it as an obstacle, like it could just drive through and over like a shrubbery or something like that. And so, you know, the humans, they see this about to happen, and they intervene and, you know, stop the first probable robot fratricide, you know, ever to occur. Right, so the capability there for doing the technological capability for sending in some kind of a pack bot or driving in and going, and so that we could assure that risk, lower that risk to the non-combatants, that I think is important. You know, it doesn't exist now, and it's very, very difficult to actually program that. It's very hard. I'm an aeronautical engineer like 25 years ago. So I'm not a, you know, computer engineer, but I understand the difficulty of that programming and the Dennett's kind of mind experiment about the robots R1, D1, and all the way up, you know, to finally R2-D2, who can't recognize that there's a battery that he needs to go get, but on that battery is also a bomb that will destroy him, and it's on a cart. And it doesn't understand that he goes, well, I need a battery, so it goes in there, and it just splashes onto the cart, and pulls the battery with it, and blows itself up. It doesn't understand the context. It doesn't understand the environment. Doesn't understand what Google understands, which is relevancy of the search criteria is everything in AI. And that, I think, is an enormous technological barrier that we've yet to work through. And it's also a moral issue to me. Again, it is, I'm going to go and take another human being's life. I ought to be able, I ought to have to be able to say to those who care for that individual, those other non-combatants who are around there, I was there too. I was with you in this moral equivalency of consent to harm on the battlefield. That's the essence of a portion of the warrior's ethos. It's an existential kind of decision making. It's difficult to understand and to explain, but there is something about being there and experiencing that and coming back afterwards and showering off the smell from the sweat of the fear of death, which has no equal in smells. There's something about that to me that's a moral kind of position. So I think yes is the answer, and it's all of those things.
I know
know we have a couple of other questions, but we also reached the time when we should be out eating and drinking. So if the other questioners can maybe buttonhole Duchesne, if you're up for that, out in the other room.
Absolutely.
Okay, then I think we will. And just to say, for those of you, obviously, who are going to be with us all day tomorrow, this is just the beginning of this conversation. So, but thank you very much for starting it.
Thanks again.